the reason I thought I knew him, because he was Johnny Cash.
Welcome, and this is Far Betterment. Welcome to Far Betterment. Today I'm joined by my friend Justin Purser. Justin and I met a few years ago when he was crowdfunding for his movie, Antuif by Sea. Antuif by Sea is this great documentary. It comes out in 2019. I'm really excited for it. But I'll let him explain a little bit more about that in the podcast a little bit later on. Justin and I don't really know each other that well. But, you know, I was lucky enough and I'm grateful to him for allowing me to do that for Far Betterment. So without further ado, here's Justin Purser. First of all, yeah, thank you so much for doing this for me. I appreciate it.
Of course.
And, you know, it's really kind of you. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on Far Betterment. That's the name of it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And where do people listen to this podcast after we do this?
Anywhere, basically. Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, all those places. So anywhere you listen to podcasts, you can pretty much get it.
Oh, good. Yeah. You have great distribution.
Hopefully. We'll see. But why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, you know, where you were born, growing up, things like that.
Okay. I was born in the most insane state in the nation, Florida. And that's where I grew up. All the way through my 20s, that's where I lived. And that's probably why I'm crazy. I grew up in a little teeny beach town called Satellite Beach, Florida, which is basically like about 10 miles south of where they launched. Well, they used to launch a space shuttle, but now Elon Musk launches SpaceX and then lands them back there. So I grew up there. It's a little barrier island. Just go over a bridge and there's a river. And then there's like about a 5 mile stretch of land. That, you know, so you have river on one side, ocean on the other side. And that's obviously why I got into surfing, because there's so much water and there's pretty much nothing else to do there. There's not even a lot of waves, but you're so bored, you'll even surf when there's hardly any waves just because there's nothing to do. So that's where I got into the surfing. And then some of my friends that I'd grown up with, older and younger, became some of the, you know, greatest, well, actually one is technically the greatest surfer in the world. And so I just kind of, I did not never even come close to that level. But what happened was, is my parents had gone to Japan. My dad had to go for a business trip. And they came back with this video camera that at the time, no one had video cameras and no one had disc camera because it was like next level. So he had bought it. And so I just started filming my friends. Like we would go to the beach and I would surf and then I'd get out, or I would sometimes just film and like just, it was, I just enjoyed it. Like, and then we would go back to my house and like watch it. And it was just kind of cool because this was pre, you know, everything, pre-digital everything. So it was amazing that you could do that. You could, no one was doing that. So it just kind of, then that sort of just grew and grew into like, let's make a surf video to, you know. Then I went to film school in Florida, and, you know, then I went back to making more surf videos and just sort of did that for a while.
So you said your dad got you that camera when he went to Japan. What were your parents like, mom and dad?
They're cool. I had a traditional life, like, okay. I had a, you know, younger sister, younger sibling, a dog, a cat, so, you know, your typical 90s, family, I guess you would say, format. But yeah, I mean, and my dad like grew up surfing too. He had grown up in that small town, and he had, you know, like he had a boat and he was always out fishing and always out, you know, like we would go to the Keys and go dive for lobsters. I kind of grew up in the ocean in one form or another. Like when I was like 4 years old, we would go to the Keys and my dad would like tie me around my waist and then clip me to the boat and just throw me over. And I would spend like 4 or 5 hours just snorkeling, like tied to the boat, so I couldn't go away anywhere. And just, I would do that all day long. Like I wouldn't stop. So yeah, that's kind of my life. It's kind of like growing up, you know, camping in vans. That, you know, that was our vacations. It wasn't like, oh, let's go skiing in the mountains or let's take this trip to Europe. It was always like, let's load up our van and our boat and let's go to some island in Florida, off Florida, and, you know, fish and spend time in the water. So
that's very cool.
Yeah.
So you went to film school out there. When did you first get into film? Like, when did you decide you wanted to do that?
It grew out of this filming surfing. And, okay. there was a television show out of Jacksonville, Florida. That this guy, Mitch Kaufman, was doing. It was like, you know, he was buying local airtime on like a cable access and putting together a surfing show called The Radical Side. A surfer out of Cocoa Beach named Brett Gardner, who had also gone to some sort of film school where he hustled himself and learned that he did an affiliate version down where we lived, like in the same thing, like cable access. So being such a small town, he knew me or I met him. I can't remember how it happened, but like, I think I was like 14 or 15 at the time. And he was probably like 20 something. I can't remember, but like he had this show. So like, and I loved to shoot surfing. So I would go shoot everything. And then he would edit it into the TV show. We would interview the local surfers and, you know, I just loved it. Like I got it, like, you know, going into those dark editing rooms at the time back in the day when you had to have all this like massive equipment and stuff. Like I loved it. I'm like, okay, this is a career path I would totally love to go. And it just sort of went from there. But like, you know, and then I just continued on, like I went to film school and then I came out of film school and then continued to make like surf movies with my friends and like travel the world and, you know, do that for a while. But making surf videos is like, it's A, there's not a lot of money in it. And B, there's just like, it's not a lot of creativity because it's just surfing, 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 surfing. So you basically, it's like shooting seagulls. Like you're just like following them. And the people, the audience who bought them at the time and even kind of to this day, they just want to see surfing. Like they don't care about anything else but the surfing. They want to see the tricks. They want to see the favorite surfers do the craziest tricks. They don't care what it looks like, where it was shot, you know, all that stuff. So it was kind of ushered in by the Momentum Generation, which was that great doc that was just on HBO about those guys and like how they revolutionized surfing. And then we kind of came a little bit after that. And, you know, so I got to the point where I did that for so long. I started when I was 15 and I just kept going and doing it. And like, you know, traveling the world with, you know, your own camera gear and lugging it in and out of foreign countries and on boat trips in Indonesia for 2 weeks and then back through customs. And then like, you know, it's, you know, being responsible for all your own travel and it just becomes, it's too much. Like it just became like, I did it for so long and I started so young that I was just like, I got my burnt out and I didn't know what to do. I was, you know, sitting in my living room. I'd come back from a trip from Barbados for Surfing Magazine. And I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. Like I can't, I'm over this. Like this is not fulfilling to me to like keep doing this. Like I can only stand on the beach for so long, you know, in like the hot sun and film surfing. Yeah. So I was sitting there and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was sitting there and like, it's almost like this weird, like, manifestation. It's kind of silly, but it was the honest to God truth. I'm not making this up. I was watching MTV and Britney Spears, Baby One More Time came on the music video. And I just stopped. I was eating cereal. I stopped. I like put down my spoon and I just stared at the screen. I was like, what is this? Like, you know, I mean, I knew what music videos were, but I never had actually thought about it as like a career, like how it works, you know? I just, for some reason, I thought Britney was really hot at the time. So of course that's probably what caught my eye first. And then I started thinking like, I'm like, what, who does this? Like, who are the people that make this? And like, how does that work? Like, you know, I have no idea how any of this works. Like I didn't know anything about it. And I was like, I don't know, but that's what I want to do. And I just was like, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to move out to Los Angeles and I'm going to try to do it. And literally from that day, like I just made a plan and I just stuck to it and did it. And I'd been out here to California a lot. I'd never been to Los Angeles a lot, but I'd spent so much time in Orange County because that's where like the surfing industry is. Like that's where all the clothing companies are, you know, the US Open every summer. So I'd always been out here for that with my friends. And like, so I knew people out here, but I didn't know anyone in that industry. I only knew people in the surfing industry. industry. I didn't know a single person in, you know, quote unquote Hollywood or music videos or anything. So, but, you know, I sold everything I owned, packed it up, and I, as much as I could in my car, and I did that 3,000 mile drive across the country.
So you just ended up in LA, and how did that change your trajectory? I mean, obviously you went from surfing to music videos, but, you know, how did you get to that point? How did you get into that?
I think looking back, it's like, I just had like, and I don't know, I kind of tell this to anyone, like, you know, you just have to, like, big ideas start, they just don't happen. Like, you have to start somewhere. And basically the best place to start any big idea is just the idea itself. And just the, I'm going to do this. Whether you make it or not, you can't even think about, like, don't even think about, like, will this ever happen? Am I ever going to be able to do this? Like, because if you do that, you'll never make it. So just focus on one step at a time and just keep going. So what I did was I moved out here. I had to start over from the bottom. Like, I lived with some friends in Orange County that were kind enough to let me live on their couch. And I would just drive to LA every day. And like, I had looked up, like, you know, music video production companies. Nigel Dick, who actually directed the Britney Spears video, had his own website at the time. So I actually emailed him and told him what I wanted to do, which I'm sure at the time he was getting tons and tons of emails. And he actually responded to me and like gave me this really nice email about, you know, his thoughts on what I should do. It was pretty nice. And so I just went around to the production companies and I gave my resume, which was basically just surf movies at the time. You know, and, just kept doing that. And then, I got, somehow I can't remember. There was an organization called the MVPA, which is the Music Video Production Association at the time. And they were sort of like the kind of overlorded music videos and like rules and regulations of like, you know, crew times and like, you know, how much you had to pay people. And like, they had an award show and they sort of were like, an organization, like a union organization in a sense, but not that strict of an organization. But anyways, I met someone there I must have emailed them and they said, oh, come in, you know, we'll see what we can do for you. So I went in and I met one of the women there and I just was like, I think she was wearing like a Hurley, t-shirt or something. And I was like, oh, do you like Hurley? And she's like, oh, I love it. And so I went and I asked, Bob Hurley, who I've known since I was a child and when he worked for Billabong, and he would help sometimes pay for me to go on trips and shoot surfing and stuff. And, I mean, to this day, like, he's still like one of my favorite human beings of all time. But I asked him if I could, get some clothing to give to her. So I like went, he said, sure. So I went to I got her sizes and I went to the warehouse and like pulled a bunch of clothes for her and then brought her a box of clothes. And she was like, of course, way more willing to help me from then on out. So she introduced me to some, you know, executive producers at, production companies. And I started from the bottom. Like, I was an intern and then I was like a PA. And then I was like, I ended up being an executive producer's assistant. And I got to kind of learn music videos, like because I had no idea how any of it worked. So I got to learn, okay, there's these directors, they're signed to these companies, you know, the record labels send them the songs from the artists and the budgets. And then they write these treatments, these ideas of what the video should be. And then they send it back to the record label and the record label and the artist pick one of the directors. And so I was on staff at these companies, like as an intern and just as an executive producer assistant. But it was really great because we got to see the whole process go down from beginning to end. And I got to like see, I was like, you know, I didn't know if I could direct a music video. I'm like, I don't even know how this works. So I got to go on the set and I got to like just stand there and be on a fly on the wall and try to learn the process and go like, do I even think I could do this? And then once I realized, yes, I think I can, then I got to sort of like hone in on how it all worked, literally from the beginning to the end. Because I never had to be on set like, you know, going to get coffee or like running and picking up, you know, food or whatever PAs always have to do. So I just kind of got to be there and not have to like work, which is great because I could really just focus and learn and watch these directors that were doing it, you know, watch them do it and learn from their different styles and techniques and how they did it.
So when did you break off and start doing that on your own?
I think it was around 2009. I went on staff at production companies and I kind of kept moving up, in my, career, I guess you'd say. Like, I went from like the executive assistant to the department coordinator. I went to a company called A Band Apart, which was, it was Quentin Tarantino and Lawrence Bender's company. And they had a commercial music video division. And that's actually where Nigel Dick, who directed the Britney Spears video, was signed as a director. So I actually got to meet him and tell him, like, you don't remember this, but like, I sent you an email and you wrote me back and here I am today. And he's the nicest guy, like nicest British guy, like so sweet. And, you know, so I got to, you know, be on set with him and work with him. And so I, you know, and then I started writing treatments for the directors. The executive producers were like, wow, you know, like, we think you're creative. Like, you know, you should write a treatment. You should help them write treatments. So I would help come up with the ideas and write the treatments. And then I left the band apart and went to a company called Anonymous Content. And they, you know, they, at the time they had, you know, David Fincher, Mark Romanek, and, you know, some of the greatest music video directors of all times. And like, you know, same thing there. I just kind of kept growing. And then I started shooting my own videos on the side. Like I would like use my contacts to help get crew members and like, you know, some of the independent record labels, I would like say, hey, you know, I'll shoot the video for you for free. And I started building my reel as a director. And at the same time, I started, you know, still writing treatments. And I started working with one of my favorite directors, Jake Nava, who had done like Beyonce Crazy in Love and like, you know, all these big, you know, big pop videos and just did them in such a more artistic way than a lot of people were doing them. So I got to work with him and write a bunch of treatments. And, you know, I got to like really learn a lot from him. And so I built a reel and the record label started to know that I had, you know, written some treatments. And one of the ideas I had sent to Jake that he had sent on to Beyonce was for Single Ladies. It was, you know, it was basically a YouTube video that had, it's kind of when YouTube started to kind of blow up and people actually started to actually like, you know, watch it and the view counter and you could see the numbers go and, you know, things were going quote unquote viral. And it was this, someone taking a 1960s Bob Fosse dance routine and they had mixed it to this hip hop song, Walk It Out. So it was these three white ladies with like, you know, beehive hairdos. And they were like doing this dance, but it looked like it was choreographed to this hip hop song. It was just funny and everyone loved it. So I had sent that to Jake and said, you know, hey, what about this for Single Ladies? Cause the brief was Beyonce just wanted a kind of a simple dance video. So, you know, he of course sent that to Beyonce and Beyonce was like, I love it. Let's do it. So they, you know, he directed it and, you know, and so it kind of got, some people started to find out the record labels that like, that had kind of come from me, even though it wasn't necessarily like an original idea, or much of a, you know, a treatment per se, but like some of my friends at the record labels were like, oh, that's so cool. Justin did that. So at that point I had a reel and I had like some clout and I was like, okay, I'm going to make this jump. I'm going to become a director on my own. And like, just, you know, finally, just, that's all I'm going to do, direct music videos. And I tell people this is, you know, I basically like spent 8 years trying to get into this party. And I was like standing outside the party and just outside the door. And like, I could see in and I knew the people in the room. And I knew if I just got in that room, I could stay in there and I could be in this party. And like the minute I became a director is right when the economy crashed again. And, you know, the record labels and the budgets just went from like, at the time, what was kind of declining to a bad place went from bad to like negative worse. Like they just dissolved. So I tell people I spent 8 years trying to get into this party, finally get my foot in the door. I'm like, I'm in. The bouncer lets me in. I'm like, I'm in. And then someone goes, that's it. Everyone over. It's over. Everyone out. Party's over.
Oh, wow.
So kind of right when I became a director, a music video director, and I had about a year of it and then it just changed so rapidly where it wasn't about creativity anymore. It was who could get it done for the money. And it didn't really matter because the bar was so low. And as long as you could get the views and you can buy the views, you know, what's the difference between, you know, 5 million views and 8 million views? Like, you know, like that's, you know, you could buy those 3 million views and go, hey, look, now we're 8 million, you know, like no one's going to question it. It just became, it wasn't what I signed up for. It felt like a whole different industry. Like, you know, all the companies went out of business and, you know, it just became this like a different, you know, it's weird. Some of the expectations were still there to deliver the product, but the budgets were like, you know, I think they were 10% of what they were when I started, you know? So I kind of just became disheartened. It was like, I spent all this time trying to like get to this level and build this career. And then it just sort of like, it wasn't there anymore. And it's come back up a little bit. Some things have changed, but it's still not good. So I kind of got really disheartened by the whole process. So as I was doing that and kind of being discouraged and not really feeling like this is where my heart's at, and it wasn't necessarily about the money. It wasn't the money I was making. It was more about the money I could I could use to create what I wanted to create. So at the time I just, you know, didn't know what to do, but I met, these people who are starting a company called Maker Studios. And I don't know. I think are you familiar with them?
Yeah. A little bit. Some of the people that were in there, at least, you know, Phil DeFranco and things like that.
Yeah. So I'd met those guys and kind of got introduced to that world randomly through a friend, Denise Cass, who was making YouTube videos at the time. And she asked me, she knew I was directing. She actually was the receptionist at Anonymous. And so she knew I was directing music videos. And she's like, hey, I'm going to do this spoof music video with this guy named Shay Carl. And it's going to be called Bearded Chick. And we're going to spoof this Akon song. Would you want to direct it? And I was like, sure. I was like, you know, I just wasn't really doing much at the time. She's like, yeah, you know, we're just going to shoot it at my friend's house. And, there will be some YouTubers in it. And I was like, I didn't know what that meant. I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. That's fine. You know? So I show up that day and like, you know, we met all these people and, you know, the kid's name, that house it was Shane Dawson. And like, I guess he just bought the house. And I'm like, he seemed like he was like 17 or 18 years old. I'm like, how did he buy a house? I'm thinking in my head. And like, there's all these like, you know, this girl named I Justine. And it's like, I'm like, isn't that supposed to be like an Apple thing? I'm like, you know, all these like people, and they're all like, you know, we're shooting them. We had a lot of fun. It was like in the video, you know, it was fun. So, you know, she was like, oh, after a couple of weeks, she's like, do you want to come see the edit? And I was like, sure. So I came by to see what they had edited, and it was pretty funny. I'm like, oh, that's funny. You know, like Shay was really fun and it was cool. And it was like, oh, that's a funny video. I'm like, you know, she's like, okay, yeah, so we're going to put it up. I'm like, okay. So I think like a few days later, I'm like, oh, I wonder how that video is doing. I wonder if anyone's watching. And I click on it, and it had like a million views. At the time, this is like 2011. So a million views was like huge. Like that was monumental because there wasn't that many people watching YouTube at the time. And I was like, I was blown away. I'm like, how did they get a million views on this thing? I'm like, what is going on here? So I started looking at everyone in the video because they were all credited. And they all had these like pretty massive followings. And I'm like, how are they doing this? And what are they doing? And like, how do these people pay their bills? So I called her and I was like, you know, what's going on here? How does Shay Carl, who has a family of like three or four at the time, like spend his entire day just making videos of himself, like, and his family, like going around Venice and like, you know, grocery shopping and stuff. I'm like, they're like 15 minutes long and get like, you know, 100,000 views. I'm like, how's he doing this? She's like, he's making money. I'm like, what do you mean he's making money? She's like, yeah, he's making like $250,000 a year. And I was like, wait, what? I'm like, he's making money making YouTube videos with his flip camera and his iMovie? And she's like, yeah. So I was like, okay, well, if I can't beat him, join him. Like, I want to know what's going on. This is a crazy world. So I went in and met like Danny Zappin and everyone, and Cass and G and everyone at Maker. And I was like, I think this is really insane what you guys are doing here. Like, I want to be a part. And then from then on, that's when things just went absolutely insane. Like probably one of the craziest times in my life, like looking back and like being a part of something that like was so massively changing of a culture, but not really realizing why I was in it. It was really cool.
How long were you there for?
Like 3 years, 3.5 years, I think. Okay. I left right as things really started changing. There's a couple reasons, and I probably should have stayed because I'd be a lot richer now. Actually, I would be rich now. I shouldn't say richer. I would actually be rich. some of my friends who, you know, stayed and cashed out their stock, like, you know, they made really good money. And I still, to this day, I kick myself for that. But, you know, it started, the handwriting was on the wall. I knew what was going to happen. As soon as, like, you know, we started creating some content and a lot of it was the content that I would direct and create. I was kind of the guy doing the more higher end stuff because I was the one with the experience. And I started also bringing in some of the brands and doing some things for, like, you know, Planet Hollywood and Cosmo Magazine and Nivea and like all these things. And like, we started getting on the radar of like advertising agencies and like in the ad world, because, you know, anytime you have an audience that people with want to advertise in front of them. So people were like, what is this? And where is this, you know, what's going on here? Like, we took number one on Ad Age and just the phones went off the hook. It was like, you know, who are these people and how did they take number one on Ad Age? Like, they're not even an ad agency. And how are they doing this? You know, how are they getting these views? So, I knew what was going to happen, and what I knew was going to happen actually did happen, which is where the minute you start to get on that radar, then the Hollywood suits see you on that radar, and then they, you know, come and cut buddy up to you and then take your company from you.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. So at that point I was kind of getting kind of like grossed out by it, because I kept saying like, you guys, this is going to happen if you don't like hold the line, you know, we got to hold the line. And then, you know, but they're so good. They just come in like, oh, you know, we love what you do. Like, we want to be a part of it. You know, we can introduce you to this celebrity, and we can get you to this celebrity, and like, we can get you, you know, this and this and this. And we want to, you know, we just want to help you. You know, meanwhile, they're like working with lawyers behind your back to like fill out paperwork to how they can like get you to sign it, to sign your company over to them, you know? And they, cause they think you don't know what you're doing. They know what they're doing because they are Hollywood executives. Although you've come in and basically like disrupted their world. So basically they want to own your world. So, that's what happened. And then eventually, of course, Disney bought it for $1 billion. And just in the last few months, I think they've actually got rid of the Maker Studios name, and now it's Disney Digital, and God knows what goes on there.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. So you got out right before that all went down, and you didn't have to deal with any of that.
Yeah, but I probably would have wanted, looking back, hindsight's 2020, I would have dealt with it, because I'd be probably a millionaire now. That's one of my biggest problems in life, is I don't care about the money and stuff. I just do it because I love it. And then the money comes, I guess. But like, I'm like, I need to rethink this whole thing. Cause like my whole, like, this is disgusting, I need to leave. Looking back, I should have been like, I'm just going to stay in this till the gravy chain, you know, ride this gravy chain till I can't ride it anymore. Instead of going like, you know what? I'm punk rock. I'm not going to deal with these corporate suits. I'm out.
Well, would you say that's like your biggest regret, or do you think you haven't hit that point yet?
Yeah, it's regret, but like, you know, there's obviously nothing I can do about it. And I, you know, you live and learn. You know, everyone I feel like has a story, especially in this town, where like they should have done something, or they could have done something and they didn't, you know? And all you can do is learn from it. And I can't say it's been a total failure. Like I've made money because of that. Like, as soon as that Disney sale went down, my phone rang off the hook. So everyone that I had known in the, you know, the industry who knew I'd been there, they were all like, what is this? Can you come tell us about this? How does this work? Why did Disney buy it for $1 billion? Weren't you a part of this? What did you do? Like, everyone wanted to know. And so I was able to turn that into, sure, you want me to pay you to consult you on how you can get views on YouTube? Sure, you can pay me, but I'm not just going to hand you all this information for free.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, I still create, one of the things I do for a living is I creative direct and creative consult. And a lot of that is like, how do you create content? Because it all starts in the creative for me and for everyone. Like, how do you create content that rises above the noise? There's so much noise, especially nowadays, there's more than ever. Like, so how do you create something that's going to rise above that? Yeah. That's actually going to be seen? Because you could create the most brilliant piece of cinema ever and upload it to, I would say Fellini could come back from the dead and upload a video to YouTube that could be his greatest film ever, and no one would see it because no one would be able to find it, because I believe the number keeps changing, but I believe right now it's 70 hours of video gets uploaded every minute to YouTube. So how do you distinguish yourself from that?
So after leaving Maker Studios, I mean, what happened going forward?
I continued to do music videos. One of the reasons I left, I was actually really busy. I was booking videos after video, and like, I had a couple, and I was just like, my contract is ending, and I hadn't gone in to renegotiate, and I just like, it all just sort of, everything was, they were really busy, everything was moving with them, everything was moving with me, and it just sort of like, we just sort of like went our separate ways. So I did some more music videos, and then I just continued to just get more and more disheartened with the experience, and like, not that I'm like a creative control freak, but part of the process that I disliked the most was the like having to like cater to, you know, cater to the notes and to the changes that wanted to be done. And not that I wouldn't listen to the artist or the record label, but like some of the stuff I felt like was just being done because they felt like they had to do something, you know. And then, you know, I got signed to a couple of commercial companies. There was a company called Believe for a while, and I kind of dabbled in that world a while and with some branded videos, but that was even more disheartening to me. Like, I just don't think again, like I think I need to rethink my whole life, because you can still make good money as a commercial director. But to me, it's just like you're tasked with the challenge of creating content that nobody ever wants to watch. Nobody ever wants to watch a commercial. No one's like, oh, I can't wait to see that commercial. You know, so it's I never understood how when I was in anonymous content, they were pretty much the biggest commercial company in the world. They were a machine, a force, doing every massive commercial there was. They had all the biggest directors in commercials. But I never thought it was cool. I was like, I don't really like, that's cool. You're making a lot of money, but like, you're not making anything cool. Like this Pepsi commercial, like that's whatever. Like, you know, like a Nike commercial, like it's shoes. Like you're just making propaganda. Like I just didn't get it. It just wasn't my thing. So I did that for a while and you can make money on it, but it just wasn't my thing. And also with commercials, like, you know, like that's something a director has nothing to do with it. As far as the creative directors at the agency take it all over, especially in the post process. So I just decided, what am I going to do? So I started thinking about it, and I kind of always liked the idea of going into, after Maker, I was like, you know, what else could change? Like, what else could I possibly be part of changing the landscape of? Because I feel like we're in an era now where like all entertainment formats can be kind of shifted and changed, you know? So I had been invited to this screening of a Serena and Venus Williams documentary. So I went and I watched it, and it kind of reminded me of two of my friends that I'd grown up with in Florida that had become two of the greatest surfers in the world, professional surfers on the world tour, who were twins. And I was like, well, their story was kind of similar, because they kind of, you know, Serena and Venus, like, you know, pushed each other and fought with each other, but to help their career. So I was like, I emailed again, Damien Hopgood, who I'd grown up with, and I was like, would you guys ever want to make a documentary film on yourself? And they both responded, which is pretty quickly, and said, yes, we've actually been thinking about that too, which is interesting, because Damien actually never responds to any email. So the fact that he responded meant he really wanted to. So we kind of went through this process. This is probably like 4 years ago, where we raised money, and we started in Tahiti, and we started creating a documentary. And at first it was just going to be kind of a simple, like, you know, piece on them. But the more I dug into their story, and the more I started investigating, twins and identical twins, like the more fascinating it became, and the more like there's something bigger here than just some simple quick story that we can tell. So it grew and grew. We raised money through private investors, and we've been on and we've been off, and it's been a process, you know. Oh, that's beautiful. Did you draw that? My 3-year-old just handed me a drawing. Good job. But we just kept going and going with it. And we're now finally in the very, very final stages of it. I keep hearing people tell me that most documentaries take 10 years. So they're like, if you finish in 4, you're in a good place. So that's kind of where I went. And I've been, you know, creative directing and creative consulting to pay the bills. And I've been directing some stuff here and there. Nothing that exciting, again, just to kind of pay the bills.
Yeah.
But my main focus and everything's been in this movie, because what I wanted to do was sort of create a new style of documentary, like a new way to tell a documentary story. And I wasn't sure I was going to be able to, because I had these grandiose ideas about how you could do it. But I wasn't afraid to try. I was like, I'm at least going to try. If it fails, I'll go back to the drawing board and we can still cut a standard documentary. But, I'm happy to say, like, I think we've achieved what we would set out to achieve. And I think people, when this film comes out in a few months, I think people are going to, be able to see that there's a different way you could tell a story with a documentary that isn't just talking heads and facts.
Well, why don't you talk about when that comes out, actually? Because that's how we initially met. Because I think you were crowdfunding at that point. And I think I saw like a trailer for it or something you put out. You put out like a small reel for it. And I think I watched it. And I reached out to you because I thought, I don't know, it was just really interesting to me. See it close to done, I think that's really cool. So I'm excited, first of all. But when does that come out?
That's a great question. We have to finish it first. We're pretty close. Like probably the next week or two, we'll be done. And we have some sales agents. We've had some distribution offers. But we're hoping to start doing some screening and premieres hopefully next month. I do want to hang that up. It keeps changing because, you know, finishing something this massive, like, it's sort of, it's challenging because, you know, I'm not dealing with $1 million budget. I'm dealing with what, you know, we've raised, and myself mm-hmm. and the couple independent producers I have on, you know, we can only do so much at a time. So, but, you know, we're definitely in the final stages now. So hopefully, you know, and as far as it being released to the public depends on, you know, who distributor buys it and when they want to release it. But we all want it out there as soon as possible for many reasons. But yeah, I think definitely sometime this year, hopefully, you know, this, at least before the summer, there'll be showings. You know, we want to tour it. We want to, like, you know, have screenings, and we're going to start entering the festivals that we think are right for it. You know, we don't really care about some of the, like, we don't really care about Sundance and all these, like, other festivals that are just, I feel like Sundance is the Coachella of film festivals now. It's just sort of like, you know, it's not really about the films anymore. It's about yeah. the parties and, like, I don't know. So we don't. And some of these festivals still have, like, old school rules, like, where you can only show it at a festival. You can't show it anywhere else beforehand. And I think that's ridiculous. So, like, and yet we're, like, not even bothering with those because we don't, not that we would even get in, but we don't even care. So to answer your questions, I don't really have a date per se. But people will start seeing stuff definitely in the next month or so as far as, like, new trailers and like, screening dates and that sort of thing.
Well, I'm definitely excited. And just so everybody knows the name out there, I mean, it's okay if I tell everybody in the name, right?
Yeah, it's And 2F by C.
2F by C, okay. Yeah,
And 2F by C, yeah.
Like I said,
you know why we add the and?
No, I don't, actually.
Why add the and? Because a lot of pay-per-view on, like, cable channels still listings alphabetically.
That's genius.
So if you name your film U2 with the word YOU, you're going to be at the bottom of the list. So I added the and. I love to just call it 2F by C, but then we're at T, starting with a T. But if I do and, we're at the beginning.
I did not know that. Okay. That's smart. I like that. I like that. So you were talking about how the, you know, Coachella and stuff like that's kind of, you know, the mm-hmm. it thing now, and it's not really about the music and Sundance isn't about the movies. How have you seen the industry change? Like, I was going to ask you, you know, if you thought it was more watered down now that there are, you know, quote unquote influencers, or if you still see things the same as when you started.
Oh, it's definitely changed massively, but, you know, I always, with all things, I feel like there's always good and bad. Mm-hmm. The bad being that, yeah, like, it's, you know, there's a million things out there. There's a million things made. There's a lot of things that technically, you know, wouldn't have been popular years ago. But is that a bad thing? Is it, you know, the power's in the people's hands, to be honest. So we can't necessarily say, I've tried to cut the word, like, this sucks out of my vocabulary mm-hmm. when describing things I don't like, especially when it comes to anything that is technically art, like music, movies, TV shows, you know, fashion. Like, I've kind of retrained my brain that it's not up to me. It's not up to me to decide if you like, you know, like, if you like Ariana Grande, like, that's, you know, I don't like her music, but, like, I can't tell you that you can't and that it sucks
yeah.
because you like it, you know, like, that's not my decision. So Fast and the Furious, I'm always like, I don't like those movies or get them at all. But who am I to say, because those are the highest grossing films, like, you know, like, apparently other people like them. So, you know, so yeah, there's a lot of things that have come out that I'm like, wow, that's terrible, but apparently people like it and they want to view it. And then also I have to realize, like, technically I'm a part of that because I helped create the influencers and the YouTube stars and all this thing and, like, bring it to the light and give them the power. So, you know, and at the time, and I'm glad, and I look back and I'm not mad I did. I'm glad I did. Like, at the time, I, you know, these people deserved it. And, like, you know, they're working really hard and people are liking what they do. So why not? Why try to, you know, why not let them do that? You know? So if they're bringing joy to someone's life and people are enjoying it, then who am I to say that it sucks? You know? So yeah, there's been, you know, there's a massive change in the industry from every, whether it be like a position behind the, you know, behind the scenes of a director, producer, editor, the cinematographer, you know, there's 100 times more people doing that or wanting to do that, than there was.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of influx of bad, but then there's also a lot of talent that's been discovered that would never have been discovered. I mean, you look at music, like there's a lot of, technically music that I would consider bad, but there's also some amazing artists that would have never, ever had the opportunity if they weren't able to put out their own music and distribute it like they can today. If it was only major record labels that controlled everything,
Yeah.
So that's where I've seen it. Like, it's good and it's bad. So, and my thing is it's, we're in an era too, where we can really change, we can change the way things are done, like Netflix changed the way we watch, shows and change the way we watch television. So, and that's where that's always what excites me now. It's like, I just don't want to do something the same as everyone else. Like, I want to figure out how we can, if I'm going to do something, I want to figure out how I can change, and do it just a little different, not totally reinvent the wheel, but how can we use today's technology and today's audiences and create something that is more exciting and different,
So would you say, cause I mean, like I said, we met kind of through your mm-hmm. crowdfunding and stuff. Would you say that obviously people are more accessible now? Would you say that's a good or a bad thing?
Both good, because like I said, like the power's in the people's hands, mm-hmm. To decide what they want. But then bad because you some of the stuff that rises to the top is like probably, I don't know, for me, I personally don't like some of it. So I don't know. But again, who am I to say?
Yeah.
So I think the hardest thing, I guess, is the amount. So the fact that so many people can create content and make content and distribute content, the amount of it that somebody has to sift through to find stuff they like is, and a lot of times people just don't have the time or the energy, so they don't do it. So that's the bad, I guess I would say.
Was there ever a time you thought like, okay, I'm done with this, I'm walking away, I don't want to do this anymore? I know you kind of touched on it but
yeah, I mean, I still do it, I think, every day. I've been one of these people that like I've actually never liked anything I've ever made. I'm not the person that like, hey, check this out or watch what I've done. I'm not a very good self-promoter, I guess I'd say, which is something I also probably need to be better at. But everything I've ever made, I don't like. I always think it could have been better. I'm always like, I wallow in the like, oh, why didn't I do this? Why can't I do this? And kind of with this documentary, I lost myself in it a bit. And like, I became like almost a mad scientist in the lab. Like I refused to like let it go and quit. I drove everyone insane, from Zach, who edited it for me. And, now I'm going through, some changes in the color correction. And like, I just was like, okay, this is it. If I'm going to kind of put my career and myself on hold for this project, it needs to be the best. I need to be not the best, but it needs to be something. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. And even though people are telling me I can't do this and it won't work and this isn't a good idea, I need to decide that for myself. And one of the things that I think that helped me lose myself in it was that I have pretty much total creative control. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I don't listen to anyone, because we did, I want to say, like 20 to 30 different focus group screenings of the film to get feedback and make changes. And I listened to people's changes and adjusted accordingly to like, okay, that makes sense. Like, that scene doesn't make sense, or this isn't connecting, or no one understands this. We need to change this. We need to redo this. But because it's like, I found the most success for myself is when I do have, when it is a single vision and it's my vision. So that, I think I'm kind of learned that I'm obsessed with being able to control things creatively. And this was something I've been allowed to. So I've really kind of just, like I said, become a mad scientist with it.
I think that's really cool though. I mean, would you say this is like your proudest moment as a creator?
I think so, because I've never done anything like long form like this and told a story. I never really thought I really wanted to tell stories, but as I look back, like all my music video treatments, all my music videos, they're always narratives. Like I'd always come up with a narrative. I'm like, no matter what, not always, but for the most part, they always ended up a narrative, like telling some sort of a story. And I was like, why am I guess I do want to tell stories. And this is, yeah, a story that, like, as I dug in, I mean, I knew the story because I grew up with those guys, but the more I dug into it, the more fascinating it became. The more, like, this is, like, there's some, this is, being a twin is insane. Being an identical twin is even more insane. And, like, the more you dig into it, and especially with their lives and in the direction they took, like, going the exact same route, the exact same career, you know, taking, you know, like, you know, using their competitiveness against each other, you know, to push each other, you know, it helped them, but it also tore them apart, like their personal lives, like helped their career, but like ruined and tore them apart per their personal lives. You know, and it trying to separate, you know, it's like you're doing this together and trying to separate. And it just like, it was good. Again, it was good and bad. And the more you dig into the story, the more I was like, wow, this is really cool. This isn't surfing. This is a universal tale. This is something I think a lot of people would be fascinated by. You know, we even have like a twin psychologist, a published twin psychologist. I interviewed her in the film to kind of break down, you know, different moments of their lives that the other identical twins go through as well. They're kind of textbook. So that's kind of interesting, fascinating. And then one thing I did that, you know, everyone told me I probably couldn't do and wouldn't work in a documentary is I have, I'm using a narrator that's not really telling the truth all the time. It's called an unreliable narrator. Like Forrest Gump was an unreliable narrator in Forrest Gump because he would say things like, "And I met the fruit guy" or whatever. You know, so he's like it's not telling you the facts. He's like sometimes like, you know, saying some things that aren't necessarily true. And so it's you know, Mark Twain would write with an unreliable narrator in his books. It's been happening for a long time. I didn't invent it, but no one's ever really done it in a documentary. And people will tell me, well, you know, you're trying to tell a story that's a factual story, but you're using an unreliable narrator. And I was like, I think it can work. So I'm legally not allowed to say who the narrator is. It's sure. A celebrity who we kind of went after for a while and did a phone call and he wanted to do it. And it was great. He's the perfect fit for it. And it works. Like we've screened it since then, since he's done it. He has to sign off on it before we can announce who's doing it. But he hasn't seen it yet. But we screened it since he's did it. And when we first put his narration in, I like flipped out and was like, oh my God, it doesn't work. This is terrible. It's not going to work. And I had to screen it for a few people. And they were like, you need to calm down. This is better. It totally works. We love it. So, you know, so it's going to be interesting because, like I said, like no one's ever really taken this approach with a documentary. You know, I mean, we have like, and he's interacting with some of the people on the screen, you know, going back and forth and talking to the people on the screen in the documentary, which is, again, that's something no one's ever really done before. So, I mean, my whole goal with it, again, was like taking my mindset of like, it's not up to me to decide what people like and what's good. So I took this whole approach to this film where I kind of took myself out of it. There's things that I necessarily wouldn't like in it, but I know that other people would, so I'm putting that in, and I'm not making the film for me. I'm not like, this isn't a film for me. This is a film for everyone else. Like, and I'm using that mentality. I use that mentality kind of throughout the entire film. Like, I want to make this fun and enjoyable for other people and not for myself.
That's interesting. Because I think a lot of times, and for myself, you know, whenever I'm doing anything, you know, career wise or whatever, it's hard not to look at something and go, I enjoy this, or, you know, I just think that's interesting. How did you get to that point, you know, as a director? I know we talked about a little bit about this privately, but method directing, could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. Like I kind of realized, especially with this movie, like, I didn't realize it till this movie, I should say, is you know, a method actor is someone who becomes the role, like in real life. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I worked with Joaquin Phoenix. He wanted to direct music videos and Anonymous, the company I was at. He knew Steve Dolan, the owner. And so he came in and had a meeting with us. And like, it was a busy day and I walked into the meeting like, oh, you know, you guys are going to meet with Joaquin. He's an actor. He wants to direct music videos. Can you guys talk to him? He's got a project he wants to do and maybe we can produce it through here. Steve was like, you know, he's a friend of mine, you know, just, you know, let's talk to him. So I walked into this meeting and I sit down and I'm like, I knew he was an actor, but I didn't even look him up that day. I didn't have time. I was like, so I sat down and I'm like, you know, I knew his brother, obviously. And I knew who his brother was. I should say, I didn't know his brother. But I was like, the whole meeting, I'm like, how do I know this guy? I'm like, I know him. I'm like, like, where did I meet him? And why is he so familiar? I'm like, I must have seen all the movies he's been in. There must be a movie. So I, after the meeting, I go back to my desk and I, you know, look him up on IMDb, and I saw the just wrapped Walk the Line. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
Wait
okay.
a minute. I'm like, that's not, that's the reason I thought I knew him, because he was Johnny Cash. He was still like, he dressed like Johnny Cash. He was talking like Johnny Cash in the meeting. He was still in character. And I was like, that's why I thought I knew him, because I thought it was Johnny Cash. And then the more I worked with him, the more I got to know him and became friends with him, you know, he would tell me that, like, he gets stuck in character. Like, he, that's the only way he can do it. He's like, the only way I can do it, I become that person. He's like, I gotta be careful what roles I take, because I'll become that person. So I just always thought that was very interesting, you know, and that's what a method actor is. And then as I started to get more into this film, I started realizing, like, looking back on some of my old projects, like, I consume myself in them to the point where, like, I just, it's like a romanticized thing where I become part of the project. And it, almost to a point where, like, I need to learn to, like, not, because it's almost too much for my own life. Like, I know, and then I think that's, I've realized that that's where the creative control thing comes in. It's because it's different for me, because it's a part of me. So I don't like to, like, let certain things go, because I feel like I'm letting a piece of myself go. So, you know, even over the last year or so, the stuff I've directed, the work for hire stuff, it's just been like, I've had to just go like, okay, I'm going to go collect this check and I'm going to do what they want me to do. And that's all I'm going to do. If the day comes when someone's like, hey, we want you to create what you want to create and they want to pay me, then I'm going to do it. But other than that, like, you know, and again, for my own sanity, like, I've learned, I don't know what I want to do moving forward. Everyone's like, you know, you're going to get a lot of work off this film. You're going to get documentary work. You're going to get off of commercial work. And I'm like, that's great. I don't honestly know what I want to do. I don't know. I think once it's out, I think my perspective and everything will change. But as for right now, I don't know.
So what excites you then? What keeps you going?
What excites me now is, like, it's kind of just like, what can I do to disrupt and change things and be a part of, you know, whether that be, a company that comes in and changes an industry, whether that be a film, whether that be, you know, anything. Like, I think that's where I've also sort of, like, had to reprocess my brain into, like, what am I good at? You know, like, what am I skilled at, and where's my brain wired? And it feels like that's where it's always been wired, and that's where it's always led me, you know, from everything from, like, getting into music videos before everyone in the world decided they wanted to be a music video director. It's kind of been my entire life. Like, I've always wanted to do things, and then everyone else wants to do them. And I'm not trying to, like, brag or say that I'm really cool. It's just some weird, it's actually quite frustrating, because I usually find out about it too early. But I've always sort of been in this, like, what's new, what's next, you know? And then on to Maker Studios, you know, it's like, you know, what we were doing in 2010, people this day are just starting, you know, they're like, oh, let's start a YouTube channel. Let's do this. And you're like, yeah, that's, I did that a long time ago. You know, so that's where I'm at. Like, you know, like I want to be a part of things that change things and do things a little different. And again, I'm not saying do things that reinvent entire, you know, genre or industry, but like I said, what excites me is the fact that we're living in almost like a renaissance period now, where, like, so many things are accessible to us that we can learn and create and do that never in the history of the world has this been, there have been a time like today.
So would you say that's, like, the most important thing to you, is changing things and being creative, or is there something else? I mean,
yeah,
even just personally.
Yeah. Being creative, not only just being quote unquote creative, cause, like, that word gets overused a lot now, but, like, rethinking things, like, and, like, what's a new way to do this? What's a better way to do this? What's a more interesting way to do this? Okay. I'll look at the troll slippers. So yeah, that's kind of where my brain's at. And, you know, if the right project is offered to me, like, directing wise, like, I'm not going to turn it down. Like, you know, this has been such a draining process as far as, you know, finishing this film. But I think once it's done, I imagine my brain will reset and probably want to tell another story, whether that be a commercial, a music video, or another documentary film, or even a feature film. I think I never wanted to do feature films. I always said I didn't. But now I think I do. I think, like, moving forward, I would want to do one.
Do you have anything in mind? And I mean, not a project or anything, but a story you want to tell or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just jot down things randomly. I have a bunch of different ideas of like stories, like whether that be documentary or like, you know, I think if I were to do like, if I wanted to do like a feature, I don't know if, I think I'd rather do some sort of a series. I think those are it's more interesting now than a feature film, like these, you know, Netflix and Hulu and the series, how they drop them. I started watching some of that series You on Netflix, and I think that's quite interesting. When I was in Anonymous, they had kind of started kicking around this something called 13 Reasons Why, which obviously now is a series on Netflix. I remember kind of hearing and reading about that. It's interesting to see that hit the, you know, hit television now. And I love that they've, you know, it's just different to me. I mean, again, it's not reinventing the wheel, but the style in which they do them is different. And that's what I would want to do.
So what would you say, I guess just completely jumping to a different subject, what would you say is your biggest fear?
Biggest fear? My biggest fear probably is being too reliant on doing these things and changing things and not being able to do it and having to take some sort of a regular job that I never wanted to take or, you know, become homeless. Yeah, I mean, and you know, I have two children now. I have a 3-year-old and a 9-year-old. So, you know, I have to obviously provide for them. So, you know, I think that's my biggest fear is not being able to provide for them or myself because I've become too reckless in my like endeavors of like, of, you know, disrupting and changing things and that sort of thing. So that's probably my biggest fear, which is good, I think, in a way, because I think it's going to balance me. I think it's going to balance me from you know, being too renegade, like maybe I was in the past.
But as far as like being reckless and stuff, do you think, so you said that kind of balances you out. Do you think you would be different if you didn't have kids? And you know, what if this didn't work out? What would you be doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I think having kids changes everyone, obviously. You have kids, you know. But I also tell people, I'm like, but I also feel like some people change too much. And I feel like you don't need to.
Yeah.
I feel like some people lose themselves in the kids. And I feel like, and then they end up like being miserable. I'm like, don't stop being who you are because that's actually not good for your children. Mm-hmm. You know, be who you are. But of course, like, you know, having kids definitely changes a lot. You know, I think it takes away a lot of selfishness because you stop being selfish for yourself. And then the way you become selfish for your children, which again, I don't think is a bad thing. Yeah, I mean, definitely having children, changed my mentality and I'm sure changes everyone's.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I agree with you. Yeah. It's really hard to see people miserable from having kids. Cause I find it to be like a really happy experience. Like I love this experience, this part of my life.
Yeah. As you know, yeah, it's you know, it can be amazing, and but at the same time, it's, you know, it's a lot of work and responsibility.
Sure.
You know? But you know, I think, like again, with everything, there's good and bad. You know.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So, I agree. 100%.
You'll have good days with your children, and then you'll have bad days. But the good thing is, everything's a phase, right? So eventually, they phase out of it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, maybe people don't realize that as much.
Everything's
temporary.
Yeah, especially when they have young kids, I'm like, just hold on. It's a phase; it will pass. Like things, everything, you know, especially when they're really young, like everything's kind of a phase.
Exactly. Okay, so let's see. Jumping back in, I guess. You know, I kind of want to ask you this: is there? You talked about Joaquin Phoenix. Is there like a favorite person that you've worked with?
Lindsay Lohan. No, I'm just kidding. I did like working with her. I don't know. I don't know if I have a favorite person per se. I have more favorite moments. Like, this is a really weird random moment, but like I ended up shooting this little video, just literally all kind of came together last minute. And it wasn't even like, it's not even a great video. It's actually really bad, but ended up shooting at Joaquin's house with him, Miley Cyrus, and Liv Tyler for my friend Jamie's Dry Love in Her Arms thing years and years ago. It just was like, it's one of those things that happened where he was like, hey, I'd introduced kind of Jamie to Joaquin. That's a whole long other story, but he was shooting this thing to raise, to like create awareness for him to like win $1 million on the show for his, for Try Love in Her Arms. Like, you know, he was like, hey, can you come up to Joaquin's like in an hour and shoot this little video with me and him? And I'm like, yeah. So I like borrowed my friend's camera. I'd never used it before. And like, I'm more of a director than I am a cinematographer. So I'm definitely not the most technical with the camera. So I'm like, okay, I'll just figure this out. So I quickly borrowed a friend's camera, came up there. And then he's like, hey, I think Miley's going to come. And like, it just ended up this one of those bizarre moments that happened. But it was really fun. And I think like that was, it was like, you know, I like things like that where they just sort of like come together randomly. And then just other, you know, I don't know if there's like people, I mean, I have some like crew people and like some that I've worked with. I think actually making this documentary was pretty interesting for me. Cause like I was there in the beginning with CJ and Damian, like when they first turned pro and made the tour, and I traveled with them, and they were the young, like, you know, up and coming kids that were like, you know, no one believed in, and like, you know, they had to fight their way, and like, you know, they were like having to prove themselves. And then kind of a strange like 360 was me traveling with them at the end of their pro career and like seeing them as like the old wise sages that the young kids were now like trying to get information from and questions about, like, you know, like, like, where do you paddle out? What do you use as your horizon? And like, you know, different surf spots. And like, so that was really cool. It was really cool again it became like almost very surreal, like traveling with them, because it was like, we did it when we were kids and now we're doing it like 10 years later. It's like, you know, not the same thing, but kind of the same thing. So that was interesting. And then the crew we shot the documentary, like that was, I loved working with all of them. It was just a lot of fun because you have to become, it's a small budget. We don't have a lot of people. We don't have a lot of money. So, you know, we all have to stay in the same places and houses, and you have to become more of a family, you know, and it's an ongoing process versus like, you know, we're shooting these 2 days and then we're done. So,
I mean, that must've been crazy growing up during that time though. I mean, watching all these people get huge. And what was that like?
Are you talking about like the surfing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was, I mean, that's weird. Look back on it now. I mean, actually I think about this for myself. I tell people this, like, it's so, when you're in the moments of these things, you don't realize them.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to, like, when these moments happen again, I'm going to try to realize them. And even with my children, I'm trying to be more in the moment when things are happening, because I look back on that. Like, I didn't, you know, at the time it just seemed like, hey, you know, this is what's supposed to happen. This is what's happening.
Yeah.
It just seems normal. You don't ever think about it like, wow, this is insane. This is very crazy. This is a very special moment in time that not many people ever get to see. You know, like, I look back and think, like, I got to, like watch Kelly Slater surf and surf with him when he was, like, you know, 16, 15 years old, like, and just be out there. And, like, and you know, a lot of people never get, well, you know, especially when he was that age, people don't get that opportunity and see that, like, holy crap, this guy is amazing, and like is something, like he has something that nobody else has, you know. And it's just like, it's, you know, you just kind of sense it. You're like, this something to this that's beyond anything, you know. So, you know, that's, I look back on that and think about that. And then even with Maker Studios, it's like that time period was like incredible and insane, but when we're in it, I didn't really think about it too much. I didn't think like, wow, we're changing the entertainment industry in a way, and like, you know, like in this, and how crazy it was and how crazy it was looking back, I see it. But when I was in it, I didn't see it. So I think that's something for everyone, and including myself, I'm trying to like see if I can see when these moments happen, if I can recognize when they're happening versus later on.
Do you, when you meet celebrities and stuff now, do you like get jaded and stuff, or, you know, when did that stop being weird, or is it still pretty weird?
I don't know. I think because I, in a weird way, grew up around pseudo celebrities, like, yeah, those guys in the surf world. So I mean, obviously it's not on the level of like, you know, like a Brad Pitt or something, but like, in a way, it's sort of like I was around it in a sense that like people wanted to know these people and take pictures with them and get their autographs and stuff. So it was always sort of like, I think at an early age, I kind of got over that quick. I don't know. Like, I don't necessarily I'm jaded by celebrities so much, but like, it's now I know the work that comes around it. Like, it's like, or just the hassle. Like, so I'm always like, I try to avoid it sometimes or like, I don't know. But at the end of the day, like, you know, it doesn't really, I guess I just don't care. Like, I don't care if it's this person or that person or whatever. Like, there's only, of everyone I've ever been around, there's only like three or four people I've ever been around where I'm like, where you can actually sense that like there's something, this person is somebody and has something. Like Michael Jordan, I got to see him a couple of times when I was younger, and like you can just like, he just has a presence where you're like, okay, this guy, even if you didn't know who he was, you'd be like, is there something about this person? I feel like Jay-Z kind of has that too a little bit, where you're just kind of like, there's something, like, you know, like you just feel it, you know. But most of the time it's just like, I mean, again, and even them, you know, at the end of the day, they're human beings. They eat, sleep, go to the bathroom, and they're going to die like all of us, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I don't know. And I think that's helped me in a way, because I don't get excited. I'm not like, oh my God, I'm going to get to work with so-and-so, or I'm going to meet so-and-so. And it's definitely like, you know, I think the people themselves can recognize that and appreciate that. You know, because it's more of like, and I've done the thing where like, I think a lot of people out here that lived here for a while do this, where you're like, I've seen famous people and then thought that I knew them from somewhere else. Like, oh, I must have met them on some set or like at some meeting or something. Like I tell people I have this, like I did that with, actually with Drew Barrymore at Starbucks one time. She was standing in front of me and I was in line, and she turned around and looked, and I was like, oh, hi. Cause in my brain, I was like, oh, I know her. Like, how do I know her? Like, I should say hi. Cause I felt like I knew her from somewhere. And she turns back around and she's like, oh, hi. And she turns back around, and I'm like, okay, who is that? How do I know her? Like, where did I meet her? Like, is she a makeup artist, or like, is she a stylist or producer? Like, I feel like I met her somewhere, and also my brain like kicks me and goes, wait a minute, you idiot, that's Drew Barrymore. That's why you recognized her face.
That is so like, but that, I think, just a whole different world.
Yeah. But it's funny, because I mean, I think in a way, because I was just like, when you turn around, I was just like, oh, hey, how are you? And she was like, oh, good, how are you? You know, so it was like, I wasn't like trying to like, I wasn't fanboying or like or anything. It was just more like a normal person would. And I figured, like, people like her, she probably thinks I might have met her somewhere too. So because they meet people like that, meet so many people. So I don't know. But yeah, I think, yeah.
Well, I think, so this kind of excites me, but I, you know, and I'm not sure how how you feel about it, but do you want to talk about Olio Creative?
Yeah, of course I would. So that Olio is a company that's about 7 months old. I kind of looking at like my Maker Studios redemption in a different way. It's a good friend of mine, Marshall Plant, who is a amazing colorist, color correction artist, and he's colored almost every single thing I've ever directed. We've just been good friends for a while. And he called me one day and said he was leaving the company he was at. He was going to start his own company, and asked me if maybe I would help him like with social media and like, you know, trolling and that sort of thing. And I was like, yeah, of course. And then I thought about it for a few hours, and I called him back and was like, hey, you know, instead of doing that, I'd actually want to be a part of the company. And I think there's some interesting things we could do with it. And, you know, so he told me about his ideas, and I listened and then told him about mine, and they were pretty much in line with what we wanted to do and how we feel like that industry, the post-production, and even specifically to color, color grading, is sort of a stale, stagnant process. And like, just, it's been the same for years and years and years, and it hasn't really evolved with the times as much. I mean, the technology has, and what you actually do has, but the business of it and the marketing of it and that sort of thing hasn't. So, you know, it's been amazing. Like, it's the company's been doing really, really well. And we're already building out more suites and the office, the small office space that we have, and it's growing. And I'm using a lot of what, I learned with Maker and how we kind of disrupted things, and that, and just some other things I've learned along the way of how you could kind of come in and, you know, disrupt an industry. And, you know, we're applying those, and it's working, and it's exciting. And we're growing and changing. And it's interesting to me because it's like, it's weird in a sense, because like in years past, a director would not be, I'm a small partner in the company. I don't own a huge stake of it, but I do own a small part. But, you know, a lot of times a director would not own part of a post-production company. That's just weird. Or like, you know, be a creative director to post-production company. But again, I feel like we're living in a renaissance period where like, instead of like being afraid to have a bunch of different things, you should be doing a bunch of different things. You shouldn't limit yourself to like, I'm a painter, I'm a truck driver, I'm a insurance salesman. Like, you should have a couple of different things going on, because in today's world, like, it's normal and you can do it. So I'm excited by it. And I feel like, the people involved, and Natalie, his executive producer, he brought over, she's amazing and fantastic. And like, we're all sort of, I can sense it now because I've been a part of these companies, like, even, Anonymous, which was like a strange company in the sense that it has so many different moving parts to it. It has, lit management and talent management and then commercials and music videos. And like, no one understood why all these things were under one roof. But, when economies crash and systems change, they can shift to a different department to help pay the bills and pay everyone's salary as things move and change, not just dependent on one vertical of income. So, I can see it from being around it now. Like, I feel like we have a really great opportunity, and I feel like we have a really great team of people that I feel like we're gonna do some things.
That's awesome to hear. And yeah, I totally agree with you. You should have, multiple career paths and stuff. I've always kind of felt like that. I don't know if you remember this show. There's a show when I was a kid called The Pretender. You remember that show? It wasn't on for very long.
I know it, but I don't think I ever watched it.
Is this guy basically who like had multiple, like he was so smart he could do anything. So he would just, be a fireman one day and, add a computer engineer the next day. But that, when I was a kid, like that was what I saw as being an adult. Like I wanted to do that. So it's really interesting to hear you say that, because I don't really hear many people say you should have multiple things going on.
In years past, especially in entertainment, it was weird. Like you were frowned upon if you did. If like, say you were a makeup artist, but you also were a production designer. Like people never understood it. They were like, no, that's not. You had to pick a lane.
And really?
Or like a director, cinematographer. Oh yeah, like, or a director, producer. Like it was bizarre. Like you almost got like blackballed if you tried to do anything else. You had to pick a lane. But I feel like in the last 3 or 4 years, like I've seen all these people do. I've seen makeup artists become big directors. I've seen like, I've seen all these things. Like I've seen people go from like a post supervisor to like, again, like producing massive multi-million-dollar films. Like I've seen strange things happen. It's like, so I'm like, I think I keep telling people I feel like we're living in a renaissance period, and we're going to look back on it in 5 years and go, wow, what, that was crazy. Like one of the examples I use is, my favorite example is Jessica Alba. Like she was a beautiful, pretty good actress,
Yeah.
And now if you would have said back then, like say during Sin City, like, do you know in like 7 years, she's going to own this $1 billion diaper company that also makes like shampoos and stuff. People laughed in your face.
Yeah.
And then like, you're out of your mind. Like that's a ha ha. Wait, the girl in Sin City is going to own that, And now she does. So, and I think it's brilliant, like so smart, like, and now she can act when she wants and do what she wants, and she doesn't have to worry about it for her living or career. And, she can probably pick and choose her roles, and she can, part of a company, a massive company. So, I think everyone should be like looking at like, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But like, I don't think anyone should be limiting themselves to anything nowadays.
Yeah. And not living in fear. And, I don't know. I think a little bit of fear is good, but, yeah.
Yeah. You have to have some, or you're going to go off the rails. But, there's so many things you can kind of dabble into and try without much risk nowadays,
Yeah.
With the technology around. So, yeah.
Well, I guess we'll kind of wrap up here, but thank you so much for doing this for me. I really appreciate it. I know everybody's time's valuable, so I always appreciate everybody who takes the time to do this for me.
Of course, yeah. I love talking about myself. I'll do it anytime.
Hey, who doesn't?